Okay, well, this evening, we're privileged to have Dr. William Galbraith to speak on a topic that I think he made up, or at least the title for the word he made up, and I think that's kind of a neat idea, because that way it's so new nobody knows what you're talking about, and you can be anything you want to be. But I know from having talked with about this topic before, you're really in for a very enlightening presentation this evening. Now, Will comes with terrific credentials, and he's got more degrees than I have hairs in my head. But he does have a PhD in philosophy, history, and the philosophy of science and theology.
How can anybody study all those topics?
Anyway, from the University of Pittsburgh, and he's got several other degrees. But Wynn has a very wide range of ideas that we can talk about, and it's all really looking forward to his presentation this evening. So without further ado, Wynn Galbraith. Thank
you. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to investigate once again something that I had made this term up 1969 or 70 or so, when I was teaching a course in philosophy of science for engineers, required course for them, and I knew that when we went over a bunch of approaches, realism, experimentalism, and so forth, they would ask me, you know, what's your stance? And so I put together my own stance and told them, I'm a consequentialist. And just to give you a clue where this comes from, the Latin word construere means to construct. In fact, we get a couple of English words out of that. One is construct, and the other is construe. They both come from the same construere. To construe is to interpret or to analyze, to figure out something, to build something mentally, to construct a mental image. Let's see if I can. Okay. Oh, now it's working. I want to talk about this on at least three levels, but I've got more slides than I could cover, so I'm going to skip as we go through it. You'll see what they are as I skip through them. If you want to ask about them, you know, feel free to ask about them later. This theory of constructivism, of how we construe things, is developed basically to handle the level of theories and the level of terms. But there are a couple of other levels that it fits on as well. On the level of theories, I think I just... Hello, are you there? I didn't manage to unplug it, that's good. On the level of theories, what I'm trying to point out is that our mental equipment is co-constitutive of our theories and of our phenomenal world. Co-constitutive, I mean, it has a part in building our theories and our world that we experience, our experienced world. I've got a couple of drawings in here a little further on so you'll be able to see more of what I'm saying. Our theories are underdetermined by reason and experience, so we do have options. This is one of the things about construing. You don't have to construe things in a given way. There's generally a lot of different ways you can construe things. So we have options. But there are constraints on these options. And we will reject a lot of these options. Some of them we will think are downright insane, or crazy, or not my style, or mildly antisocial, or something of that sort. So we have a lot of reasons for rejecting them. We don't all agree on which options to reject. So we have disagreements about things. Now, on the level of terms, meaning is constrained, and what I'm dealing with here, construing the meaning of a term, is a theory of meaning. Okay? Meaning is constrained in two major ways. One is or from the society around me that provides the language that I use. The terms have not just a range of meaning, but a range of ranges of meaning. For example, take a look at the word runs in this sentence. Are we talking about baseball, or about nylons, or scientific lab results, track meet, political campaign? The runs might be, you know, three runs of the candidate, or they might be the runs of the campaign manager. And the concept of run is a little bit different for each of these. In fact, there are hundreds of meanings of the word run in English. Look it up sometime. It's fun. Back to this slide. The other constraint is the attempt that I have of trying to communicate something. So I want to pick a word that actually fits somewhere in the vicinity of what I'm trying to say. And unfortunately, these constraints don't always overlap. And when they fail to overlap, we have malaprops, or maybe errors. The first two are taken from the play, Schlegel and Lazarus or something, which was, you know, in the 1700s in English, play with the interesting concept of Mrs. Malaprop, who said various things. And I told me in your way, I couldn't see this at all. Rock back and forth. Mrs. Malaprop is the one who says the first two. In the first case, it's clear that she's striving for the word miracle. Okay, and she gets the P-I-M, but she comes up with pineapple. In the second case, it's a little fuzzier than that. My guess is that she's concerned that something that she said is going to be badly quoted on her tombstone. But, you know, I don't guarantee that interpretation. Now, in the third case, if we just have this sentence, typically we won't know what in the world is going on. Did the person who said this mean Freudian slip? Or did they maybe mean the person they're talking about is too overly concerned with sex? Or, you know, is there something else? Now, if we had a broad context where somebody had spelled out, this is what I mean by the Freudian error, then this sentence would be salvageable. Okay? And so it depends on the context. Now the last one, this is actually a slightly varied quotation from Mort Slick about Immanuel Kant. And it's just flat out wrong. And the reason it's wrong is that although Kant called himself a transcendental idealist, he was not what we call an idealist. He did not deny the existence of reality. Now, one of the things I'm trying to point to is that meanings are not really preset, but they change within a range, depending on the context. Take a look at this sentence. I'm sure that, you know, nobody here really understands this sentence because I made up the word rat foods. It's an empty term. And a lot of people who see a sentence like this would say, well, okay, rat food is meaningless. The rest of the terms still have meaning. But actually, I don't think they do. They lose meaning. They have some meaning, but they lose a lot of meaning. For example, what do you mean by largest in this sense? Is largest the biggest volume? You know, the tallest? The heaviest? Or maybe it's a matter of denominations, like, you know, the $20 bill is larger than the $10 bill, even though they're the same size. Or maybe a lemon fruit is a power generator, and I'm asking if you can loan me the one that produces the most power, or uses the most gas, or whatever. Okay? And we don't really know what life means. The same thing is true of your ability to lend me a lemon fruit. What does it mean to lend a lemon fruit? Is this something, you know, are you going to get it back? Is this like lending a neighbor a cup of sugar? Is it like lending 25 cents or $25 or $250? If it's $250, I want it back. If it's 25 cents, I might not care. Or is it like lending your good name? for a petition. So we don't really know what that means. This basically leaves us just as actual personal pronouns, and those lose a bit of meaning because of the vacuousness of Ramafruge. What kind of person lends a Ramafruge? What kind of person borrows a Ramafruge? If I knew what Ramafruge was, I would have opinions about all of these questions. But since I don't know what Ramafruge is, I don't have an opinion, and I can't nail down the meaning of any of these terms. So, some implications of constitutionalism. If I'm right about what I'm saying, I'm not going to be able to prove it. If I could prove it, I would at best prove that I'm wrong. Because I'm saying we have a range of options that is not constrained by reason or experience. It is constrained by reason and experience, but not entirely. This, however, does not lead me to relativism. It does lead me to a different opinion about the nature of scientific progress. Those two items we'll get back into at the end of the presentation. I can only make a proposal and let you make of it what you choose. And I also must sit lightly on what I'm saying, on my instruments, and I have to wait to see if something better would come along. So in the rest of the paper, I'm going to finish my introductory comments by looking into some of the philosophical relatives of constitutionalism, what some of the other options are. And then we'll take a look at the memory prediction model of intelligence by Jeff Hawkins, which has been published in his book called On Intelligence. And then we'll take a look at the theories of Thomas Kuhn and cite a few conclusions, and then I hope to have some time for questions and answers. So one of the relatives is naive realism. This is the untutored view. Things are the way I see them, and they have the properties that I sense. How do I know? Because I sense them. I see the candle. I can see that it's a red candle. I know the candle is red. The flame is orange, etc. But sometimes conditions change. Sometimes we see things in a context which changes the impression. So that the thing that looks one way at one moment looks a different way in another moment. Look at this example. This comes from Wikipedia. Take a look at squares A and B. Those squares are actually the same color. It doesn't look like it. Because the mind construes them as different based on all the clues which have been cleverly set up to fool you. If I could show you, and I can't really do it right now, if I could show you square A and square B with nothing else, you would see them as the same color. The same shade of gray. They have the same number of pixels of gray. Let me go back a bit. Oh, can't do it that way. Yes. If I put my hand over the flame, I will experience pain. But the pain is not in the candle. It's in my head. If I look at the flame, I will see orange. But the orange is not in the flame. It's in my head. What I'm looking at here is, and what I see, is something that I have constructed. Okay? It's a phenomenal entity, which is in my head. Now, the candle itself is not in my head. So, a more sophisticated position is representative realism. Okay? I look and I have a perception of something, and I know somehow I'm gathering, I'm guessing, I'm construing that conception to be of some object. But I can't prove it. I don't know for sure what that object is like. Now, I don't really have a problem with this as long as we know that this is a construent in here. That that is not necessarily one-for-one with the reality behind it. So constructivism would accept something like this, but with some care. Now the idealists say, well, you don't know if there's an object out there at all. So, get rid of it. It is logically possible to argue that, as Bishop Barclay did, for example, God puts these ideas in your mind, and you have the same ideas when you look at something else that somebody standing next to you has, basically, of what you're looking at, because God is nice and he puts the same ideas in everybody's head who's looking from that perspective. So we can talk about things, but of course they don't really exist. Not, you know, out there. They only exist as ideas in our mind. In fact, it's logically possible to hold that God created the entire universe 5 minutes ago, complete with all the memories that we have. And, you know, those memories are fake. They didn't really happen. He's deceiving us. Now, I want to turn to a bit of the history of philosophy here. It's astounding to read the biographies of Hobbes and of Descartes to see that they have the same thing happen to both of them. They both stumble across Euclid, and they both are astonished at the power of Euclid's proof for various theorems. And they both decide, let's use that same idea that found science, so that the science, our conversations about reality, will be, you know, provable. We will know what we're talking about, just like Euclidean geometry does when they talk about triangles and circles, etc. And so Descartes is the father of the rationalist tradition, okay, in modern philosophy. But the rationalist tradition fails to succeed in this effort because rationalism, reason, proceeds on premises. And premises about reality, indubitable premises about reality, scarce. I mean, I'll give you cogito ergo sum. But then what? You know, what am I? Am I a mind in a back? Am I, you know, a mental ghost in a machine? Or just a, you know, a ghost, an idea in the head of God? Or whatever, okay. The empiricists failed because they couldn't get beyond sense data. I got this impression, this, what I call, construing. Okay? But how do I know what I'm construing beyond that? How do I know what's out there that gives me this impression? They couldn't prove the substances had external existence. And further, they were committed to the idea of induction. It's interesting that when Moritz Schlick moved to Vienna found the Vienna Circle there, he was one of five. The position that he took over was the chair that Mach had held. And that chair was called the Philosophy of Inductive Sciences. Because at that time, everybody thought science was a matter of induction. You look, here's a white swan, here's a white swan, here's a white swan. They're all swans of white. Okay? And that's how we go about gathering scientific truth. Now I'm going to jump past this for time's sake. But if anybody's interested in Popper's falsifiability criteria, we'll bring it up later. Kant asks three questions. How is mathematics possible? How is science possible? And is metaphysics possible? You notice the difference in form. Because he concludes that metaphysics is not possible. This is in the Critique of Pure Reason. It brings it back in the Critique of Practical Reason, because we still have to operate, and we have to operate on the basis of something. But for math and science, he does come up with something. He says we can divide all statements into a priori and a posteriori, and into synthetic and analytic, and that gives us two forms of division, which gives us four groups. You understand?
I'm sorry, you already
know. Yeah.
Go back to that.
Yes. The words that you said last time.
Yes.
Turn that to life.
A priori means from before.
Okay, got it. Okay.
And a posteriori means from afterwards.
Okay.
Synthetic and analytic are English.
Okay.
Basic idea of synthetic is I'm actually saying something in a statement about something.
Okay.
Analytic means that if I analyze the words, I'll see that this is true or false just based on the analysis of the words.
Do you believe that since we can divide all statements into...
No.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to jump past this. So Kant finds two forms with which the mind flows all experience. Everything that we experience is experienced in the context of space and time. I think he's right on that, by the way. And so maybe we can come up with a synthetic a priori statement. That'll be a necessarily true statement about real things, which would then be a good foundation on which to build science. Okay? And one of his examples is, you know, all experienced objects are locatable in space and time. Now he also found 12 categories, just looking at Aristotle's analysis of affirmations. In front of these 12 categories, he gets 12 more forms. I call them forms, but he called them categories. Things that we can see are necessarily part of our experience. For example, every event has a cause. It's just the way the mind works. Okay? We don't know what the things out there really have cause and effect. But when we experience them as cause and effect, whether that's true or not. So Kant's view looks sort of like this. Ding an sich is German for thing in itself. And you'll notice this is very similar to that representative realism that we had before. But now we've put brackets around the ding an sich. Kant says, I don't know anything about the ding an sich. All I know is what's inside the mind, which are all the perceptions that I have, and what I make of them, and also what I make of myself, the perceiver. And I cannot step outside the mind to look to see how my perceptions compare with realities outside the mind. I mean, that seems kind of obvious. I can't get outside my mind to see how what's inside my mind compares with what's outside my mind. Because when I step out of it, I find with it. So knowledge should be limited just to this phenomenal area. This is the phenomenon. This is the noumenon. Problems with Kant's view.
Here's where I say, hey, we eventually decide the synthetic and analytic distinction and the a priori and posteriori distinction both break down.
People see them differently, it's hard to draw the exact line where they are, and so forth. So we really can't use that approach. Space and time, it turns out, are not always and necessarily conceived the same way. Up until non-Euclidean geometries, they weren't. Okay, but with Lobachevsky and Riemann, we have non-Euclidean geometries. And then the 12 categories that he comes up with are far from exhaustive, and they're too static. Kant assumed that human minds were pretty much the same by the nature of them being human minds. It's part of the nature of the beast, you know. This is the way humans are. But in fact, humans are quite different from one another and have different mental capabilities, mental approaches. So, synchronistically, that is, at any given moment, our linguistic and mental capacities are far more flexible and far less uniform than Kant thought. And then diagnostically, that is through time, with the developmental characteristic, and there is a developmental characteristic, it's not just biological evolution that gives us mental capabilities, it's also our cultural evolution. And beyond that is the individual evolution of it, you know, building one's own mind, understanding, learning things, and struggling to communicate. So all of these deal with and shape the mental apparatus that we have. What kind of got right, I think, are the fact that the capacities of the mind determine and contribute to what we can and do experience. We cannot experience something that we cannot experience. Okay, he makes a stress and puts a stress on the difference between the phenomenal world and the noumenal, and says that knowledge should be limited to the phenomenal. And I think he's right on that. We make some, but not all, of our knowledge claims based on what the mind brings to experience, rather than what experience brings to the mind. He also made a useful distinction between pure and pragmatic reason. Now his forms and categories are not correct, but they are suggestive. So on a meta-theoretical level, Kant's position came in the 1800s to be known as constructivism. When I said the word construct is coming in here, Kant never called himself a constructivist, never used this term. But a lot of people did use it of Kant and said, basically, you can see how Kant is constructing the world. Okay? And in that sense, I'm a Kantian. But I don't want to use the word constructivism. It has too much baggage. Particularly because of Kant's baggage. Poincaré came up with conventionalism. Yeah, now we'll look at this one. These are a bunch of quotes from English translation of Science and Hypotheses. The axioms of geometry, therefore, are neither synthetic a priori judgments, as Kant had thought, nor experimental facts, as some in the Vienna Circle would try and say. They are conventions. They are merely disguised definitions. The question, is Euclidean geometry true, is meaningless. You might as well ask, are polar coordinates true? Now, are they truer than Cartesian coordinates? No. They're conventions. Is the metric system true? Conventions can't be true or false, only more or less convenient. And the same applies to scientific laws. And theories cannot be confirmed or falsified by experience. Experience is frequently corrected by theory. And if any of you have taken a physics lab, you know this, because you took out your graph paper, you plotted your observations, you drew your curve according to the theory, and you said, well, I was off that far here, and off that far here, my experience was wrong there, but generally falls on track. And then the last part of your physics lab is explaining the error that you made. It was a little dark in the room, the measurements were imprecise. We had a vacuum tube, but somebody else nearby turned on their vacuum, it wasn't the amount of vacuum we had, etc. So you come up with a lot of explanations for the error in your observations. You don't change the theory. I'm going to skip past some of these. I want that one. No? The world is full of these irresolvable arguments. Consider the argument over whether altruism or love exists. We had this one in our humanist discussion group recently. Whether altruism really exists, and what its nature might be. Whether predestination or determinism holds. Whether animals can think or have ethics. Whether Obama's efforts to hurry the H1N1 vaccine show his concern for us, or show that he's part of a global conspiracy of those not born here to poison us and take over our country. he can hold a position like that. Maybe he can do. Some of us will regard that position as crazy. But to prove it's another case. whether Keynesian economics is good for us. Are the Democrats or the Republicans right? Etc. These are construments. Okay? The positions people take on these topics are underdetermined by reason and experience. And that's basically what I mean by a construment. They come up with a stance, but you know, it is not something that you can give a conclusive argument for or against. Now, people do convert from one stance to another. And the reasons for holding one or another stance tend to be traditional, social, perceived gain, etc. I'll talk about more of this when we get into some scientific examples. Then these other metaphysical stances, or meta-theoretical stances, like realism and idealism, conventionalism, they don't really give you a reason why this happens. Realism, for example, hey, if I really could understand what really is out there and prove it, then we wouldn't have these arguments about whether Obama's trying to poison us, or etc., whether the Republicans are right. For that matter, you know, we could throw all of one group into jail for spreading malicious lies, because we could prove it, but we can't. So what do we need further? Mechanics of the mind were defective. So we need a better theory of how construments develop from the mental operations. And Hawkins provides this. And it would be nice to know that this is not just a theory spun from one old man's dreams, but it actually happens this way in science. And of course it happens this way everywhere, but I'm going to zero in on science. And Kuhn provides this. So dealing with Hawkins on intelligence, Hawkins points out that memory, intelligence, awareness in mammals seems to be a function of the mammalian cortex. In the movement, they don't have these things. The structure of the mammalian cortex is new, and in humans, he says we have about 30 billion neurons in the cortex with an average of about 1,000 synapses each, which gives us 30 trillion synapses, which we can use for memory, for storing memory. I've seen estimates as high as 100 trillion. Now, it's interesting that 90% or more of the cortex seems to have the same structure. And it looks like this. I know you can't read these statements on the sides. This is actually two diagrams, two drawings. On the left, someone has drawn a group of cells with dendrites, or axons, communication links between them. It's about 2 millimeters from here to the top. So this is, you know, greatly expanded. On the right, you see an effort to convey the density of fibers, connecting fibers. And you can see that they're all over the place and they come in masses. Everybody tends to agree that there are 6 levels here of cell. Well, the top level, which is level 1 up here, is not full of cells. There are very few cells there. There are a few, but very few. That's mostly a mat of dendritic connections, okay, from below. Say if you take a look at a circuit board with pieces that have been put onto the circuit board, and you see a connection, at least the old ones, you flip it over, you see all the wire going in each way. Okay, that's what you're looking at on the top there. Beneath that, this layer of small pyramidal cells, there are 2 layers. So this is 1, 2, 3, and this whole thing here is 4, 5, 6. This is the large pyramidal cells, and this is the layer of polymorphous cells, meaning multiple forms. So everybody agrees that there are 6 levels here. What's not for certain is how this thing functions. Hawkins, looking at this, says, from the uniformity of the structure, he's going to follow Mountcastle, who theorized that Uniformity of structure implies a uniformity of function. It works the same way all over. I'm going to go back to that previous slide for a minute. We're getting signals coming in at the bottom here from sense organs, and they are electrochemical discharge patterns. I'll show you one in a minute. They come up through here and are processed up through this section of the cortex, come out the top, and re-enter another section of the cortex, where they are reprocessed, come out the top, enter another section of the cortex, etc. Multiple sections in a hierarchical form. This we know. And we know something of what the functions of these cells are, but not everything about them. Okay, so the only input that we have is the collection of electrochemical discharge patterns, and these come from the sense organs and from various sections of the brain, including the cortex itself, because it feeds back. We also have not only this forward processing that I talked about, but backward processing and side-to-side processing. And that's why you see those layers of fibers going across. The cortex creates our awareness of whatever we are aware of from its perceptions of patterns in these discharges. So externally, if you look into somebody's brain, you can see, I already checked, electrochemical discharges. They look like this if you graph it. Okay? This is a very simple action potential. You get at any given point on an axon, you get a change in electrical potential. And then when it gets to the end of that nerve, there's a synapse and a chemical interaction with the next nerve, which then sends another electrical pattern down to another chemical pattern, and so forth. Now, this is a very simple case. If we were talking about dendrites, they would look a little different. And we're only looking at one specific pulse. What they do to find these charts like this is they take 1,000 examples. Here's a stimulus. We graph 1,000 examples of that stimulus. We put them all one on top of the other and let the pieces negate each other until we come up with an average that looks something like this. Hawkins doesn't really attempt to give us a precise mechanism for memory other than to suggest that the synapses are involved in storing and recognizing discharge patterns. What happens is that we have, you know, a cortex like this, but it's really hierarchically structured. Signals from here go to here, signals from here go to another section here, and so forth. Okay, so it gets processed and reprocessed and reprocessed. Hey, each cell which is receiving signals is receiving signals from multiple cells that process below it. So we get pyramids, okay, of input. By the way, it takes a lot fewer synapses to store a label than it takes to store what the label represents.
Is there an order of magnitude associated with that? Is it many fewer?
There would be, but I couldn't give it to you. I really couldn't. And it would be quite large. Quite large. I'll go to the next one. Here we go. Hawkins, by the way, used to write software for Palm computers and Trio and so forth. He's very much interested in computers. He's also very much interested in the difference between the way computers operate and the way the brain operates. The cortex stores not patterns of ones and zeros, but sequences of patterns. When you hear a song, you hear a set of notes, but you also hear the distance between the notes, both in time and in frequency. And these may be even more important than the precise notes. So the lower levels of the cortex, as they pass information to the higher levels, are passing a set of signals, which look like that one that I showed you, but much more complicated. Much more complicated. And the higher ones, when they get a stream of these things coming in from multiple locations, say, ah, that's my song. And so they send off a signal. Or they say, and they don't send off a signal. Or they say, and they send off what they got for somebody else up there to figure out, what is this? The cortex recalls patterns auto-associatively. There's something similar about a pattern. It may be the distance between the notes, or in time or in frequency. If you think, for instance, of a pattern of 1, 3, 5, and then has a very similar pattern to 2, 4, 6. All the notes are different, but the distance between them is very similar. So whenever one of these layers of the cortex spots something similar, it says, maybe not, and sends off a signal. It stores things, and in an invariant form, and we'll get into that a little bit more later, it stores things in hierarchy. You've got my concept of the hierarchy. In fact, he spends a good deal of time showing that most of the things that we experience, for example, face, is a hierarchy of nose, eyes, mouth, etc. Now, the mouth is made up of teeth, lips, etc. The eye is made up of the pupil, corner of the eye, eyelashes, whatever, okay? So there's a hierarchy that starts from very small details and builds up to the concept of face. Or builds up to the concept of the song. An interesting thing is, if you hear and recognize a song before, you've heard it several times, it's in your memory somewhere, and you hear it again, you will know what the next note is. Okay? Even if this time it's in a key that you've never heard before, a voice that you've never heard before, accompanied by a piano that you've never heard about a piano before, etc. Okay? You still know what's coming next. This is an example done for visual processing. And actually, this is a pyramid. I didn't want to try to draw all the boxes, so I just put a stack. Processing, by the way, goes both up and down. Because the higher levels will send signals down to the bottom level saying, forget that, it's not that. It's something else. I know what it is. Forget that. Down here at the V1, which is in the occipital lobe of the brain, at the very back of the brain, any given cell at this level is active only when a tiny region of the retina is activated. There's a one-to-one mapping between regions of the retina and regions of the V1 section of the brain. So that when that particular region of the retina is activated, this cell activates. And this is changing very rapidly because the eyes are circadian, moving back and forth all the time. So you see very different things. And we're looking at edges that move, light and dark, etc. Tiny details. But as we process this and send the signals out, when somebody says, I know what that is, and sends out the signal and several other people do too, then up here it gets processed, oh, I know what that is, and sends a signal out. Up here, IT doesn't stand for information technology. It stands for inferior temporal lobe. Okay, in the inferior temporal lobe of the brain, there are specific cells that are designed from birth to process faces. And there are a lot of other cells that become associated with particular objects, like dogs, or cats, or whatever, birds, circles, triangles, okay? And the cells up here are very slow to change. They have a very steady pace. They're constantly saying, it's a face, it's a face, it's a face, it's a face. Okay? But it doesn't tell us up here where the face is or what the angle of the face is. It could be upside down, it could be on the slant, it could be occluded. you know, all kinds, it could be a lot of noise, visual noise there that prevents us from seeing it very well. But we will have a cell up there shaking its face. Now, if you want to know where the details are, you know, where's the eye that knows them out, you're going to come down here somewhere and you'll find those. So where do we get these useful concepts of a ball and a circle?
For example, none of us have ever seen a perfect circle. So all of us have an idea of what one is.
Well, if we go back,
on the high level, the IT section,
inferior temporal lobe, there will be a cell that has been designated as the memory cell for servants. It will recognize servants. And another one for dogs, it will recognize dogs, etc. So we not only have, and these should all, of course, be pyramids, but I couldn't show pyramids. For touch, audition, and vision, we have these similar processes going on. And they have feedback. If
I hear somebody, saying, "Honey, I'm home," and the door opens, I have a good idea of what I'm going to see before I see anything.
On the other hand, if I hear, and I don't have a large dog, but if I were to hear a large dog barking, and then the door bursts open, I would have a different impression of what I might see. And these, we've already talked about them, I'm going to go on. So we have forward and backward processing. And this backward processing can fill in what you don't sense.
It's interesting that when you look at the wall, you don't see the wall moving like this. But that is what's happening on your V1 section of the brain. So the processing that's going on is stabilizing it. Okay, the eyes are actually moving. But the world doesn't shake with the motion of the eyes.
You're told, thunders down below are told what they're seeing. Okay? And it can preempt forward processing by inhibiting things. I may identify something strangely. I can make mistakes. I make guesses. Okay? I make construments. I construe things. So, separate them out of pockets. Cortex does not work by formal logic. It's guesswork. It's construed. The cortex will likely find something familiar, sometimes suggested construed, even for a first-time experience. We had our three-year-old daughter in the back of the granddaughter in the back of our car driving through our neighborhood, and she said, "Those people have an elephant in their front yard." And I said, "Where?" "That's unusual. Where's that?" And she pointed it out to me. And what she was pointing to was a large, stubby tree trunk. Okay, that had been lopped off about 10, 12 feet off the ground. It was very irregular, but it did have a separate trunk out in front of it, like an elephant trunk. I would not have thought of it as an elephant, but she did. She construed it as an elephant. Now, there's no law for foundational propositions or for proof. There is recognition and metaphor, artistic imagination. Similarities are being suggested and sought out. It's about Kuhn on scientific revolutions. Science progresses in two ways, Kuhn says. Normal science and revolutionary science. Actually, there's a pre-normal science phase, too, but let's ignore that. Normal science is puzzle solving. And for the puzzle solving, the scientists are handed a stack of rules. This is the way you do it. Okay, you were taught this in your class, in your introductory classes. This is how you solve these puzzles. This is the sort of metaphysical entities that you utilize. This is how they relate to one another, etc. So now explain these things that we experience. And the paradigm determines who, who's going to evaluate this, and the people that have accepted that paradigm will
determine the rules you use, the examples that are good examples for you to follow, etc. And over time, what happens is that anomalies show up, things that can't be very well explained by that particular paradigm, that example of how you do things, okay, or how you solve puzzles. Now, revolutionary science happens when somebody comes along and explains some of these anomalies using a different paradigm. And that's the revolution. Normal science requires significant commitment to a paradigm. Otherwise, the scientist simply wouldn't put up with the effort. Okay? You've got to be committed to this way of looking at things, or you would say, heck with it. So resistance to paradigm change is going to be high. In fact, Kuhn at one point talks about the dogmatism of certain scientists, and subsequently I think he felt embarrassed by that, so downplayed that. The term paradigm refers to examples of how you do things, how you solve puzzles, and we can more or less classify them according to, you know, the way science is presented in different epochs, like Newtonian mechanics, Copernican astronomy, Ptolemaic astronomy, Hartonian uniformitarianism versus catastrophism, Darwinian evolution versus creationism, string theory, etc. There were, at one point, a little while ago, 5 different variations of string theory, all saying, no, they're all wrong, we got it. And then it turned out, hey, if you had another dimension, they're all the same. The paradigm distinguishes the social group of those who are committed to this particular paradigm, and peer review helps to keep those paradigms pure. So that other people, you know, with slightly different variations of how to solve puzzles don't get published. The paradigm distinguishes the social group. I mentioned that, okay. Failure to solve a puzzle using a paradigm is not taken as evidence against the paradigm. It just means that the scientist is not very good at using those tools. And you don't blame the tools for the job the carpenter does. So you don't blame the paradigm when you fail with it. Acceptance or rejection of the proposed solution is still within normal science. Normal science ends when a new paradigm replaces the old. And typically, some of the adherents of the old paradigm will never be convinced. They will continue to insist that they had it right until they die. And then the old hobbies are gone and the world is now belonging to the new paradigm. So revolutionary science involves replacing the old paradigm. And in the face of an established paradigm, this doesn't happen unless the new paradigm can explain some of those anomalies that the old paradigm hasn't explained, as well as some of the things that the old paradigm did explain. And this is typically done by an outsider or by a youthful new recruit who hasn't been fully socialized in or indoctrinated into viewing things in this way. And this is another reason why all the great advances in the history of science tend to come from youthful people. It's not that young brains are so much better than old brains. It's that the old brains are set in their way of looking at things, and the youthful brains say, let's change things. Let's do it differently. Arguments for and against paradigms tend to be circular, and they're never fully capable of demonstrating their point. They're neither fully rational nor fully irrational. It is wrong to say that Kuhn says it's all done on a rational basis. Not so. Lots of rational arguments on both sides. Okay? It's just that these are instruments, folks. It's underdetermined by reason and experience. It's like a gestalt shift. A perceptual transformation occurs. What were ducks before the revolution are now lions. And the new scientists who see that these are rabbits, they're not going to allow that they could be looked at as ducks. Okay? See them as rabbits. there may also be a loss of precision or explanatory power that comes with the new revolution. I studied under Leibniz and called these things Coon losses. You know, a Coon loss occurred with the Copernican revolution. We'll come back to that one in a minute. So what are the bases for the decisions on paradigm choice? Scientists on both sides are typically committed to the same values. Okay? Accuracy, particularity, quantitativeness, simplicity, scope, consistency with other theories. But they differ with regard to how to apply these constraints. And they also differ with regard to which are the more important phenomena to account for. Well, the one that I account for last week, that's the important one. They also differ on reasons drawn from traditions, social relations, or perceived personal benefits. For example, you know, what's my religion? Where's the action in this field? Who can I study under? Who is my mentor? Who's my thesis advisor? Where can I get a grant to study this problem? Do I already have tenure so I don't have to worry about it? It's a... Wait a minute, that's the same. Okay. One of the, did I skip one? Let's go back. On the meaning of incommensurable, Kuhn says that the two theories, the old theory and the new theory, there's always two. That you always have a choice between two. There's only one. There's no choice, people use it. It's only when you get two possibilities that there's a choice to make. The concept, he says they're incommensurable. They're not really something that you can translate into a single language and understand and compare them very easily. That doesn't mean it can't be compared, but it means it's not easy to compare. So the concept is taken from geometry, where it describes the problem of comparing the length of the hypotenuse of a square with the side. It turns out there's no rational number, like 2 to 1 or 3 to 1 or 14 to 7 or 14 to 9, you know, 9 to 21 or something. There is no such number. It's an irrational. Okay? In the case there, it's a square root of 2, which just goes on and on and on forever. Now, in the history of science, there are many examples of variant conceptual schemes that simply lack a rational basis for decision. Okay? So they are similarly incommensurable. For example, astrology and astronomy, alchemy and chemistry, behaviorism and psychoanalysis. This actually, in the history of Kuhn's writing, goes through three stages. But there's a great deal of similarity. It's just a matter of emphasis. To begin with, he talks about paradigm shift, gestalt shift, saying that some of the basic terms change. Okay, subsequently, he says, well, what we really have are two different networks of linguistic usage. Okay? And the terms are attached to phenomenal reality in different ways. And the distance between the nodes is different, like French compared to English. Or, you know, Kant used two words, der Verstand and das Verstehen, which are both translated in English as the understanding. You can see how confusion can breed that. Okay? Because the languages just don't match up. It's not like this. Finally, it comes to say, well, look, what you're really looking at is local taxonomic change. That is, the way you break things up and label them changes in time. But actually, he's been saying all of this all along. Let's take a look at a couple of examples, and then I'm going to speed up. The Copernican Revolution is not just a change from the Earth being the center of the solar system to the Sun being the center of the solar system. Take a look at this sentence In the Ptolemaic system, planets revolve about the Earth. In the Copernican, they revolve about the Sun. That sentence is incoherent because there is no meaning of planet that can be used on both halves of the same sentence.
It's very interesting. Actually, the word planet only occurs once, but there is a they which refers back to planet. So we've got the concept of planet in both halves of the sentence, but the concept cannot be the same because the Earth becomes a planet and the Sun is no longer a planet and its motion is only apparent. The Moon loses its planet status to become a satellite. And the number of planets drops from 7 to 6. Now this is important because this has theological and calendar implications. 7 is the number of perfection. The heavens are perfect, there should be 7. 6, by the way, falling short of 7 is the number of sin. So Copernicus, in introducing this way of thinking, introduces sin to the heavens, which is sinful, to no no. On top of which, you know, we have 7 days in a week, named after the planets. Saturn, you know, for Saturday, Sun for Sunday, Moon for Monday, etc. We changed it, you know, used some German names as well. The idea is if you only have 6 planets, maybe we should have 6 days in a week, etc. Now, we don't sense the Earth moving. Therefore, the realist would say it's not moving. And until Kepler revised the planetary orbits to ellipses, the Ptolemaic system gave more accurate predictions. So a lot of people point this out. He gave more accurate predictions out of the Ptolemaic system. Why bother with this crazy introduction of sin to the heavens? Take a look at phlogiston and Lavoisier. It's not correct that phlogiston is merely negative oxygen. At the time, it was widely accepted that matter was essentially formless. Okay, in order to get some kind of a form out of matter, you had to impose not only some element, but some principle, which would then give it liquidity or gassiness or solidity and various other properties that it would have. Now, Paracelsus, who was born in 1493, had 4 elements and 3 principles, which gives you the good number 7. and everything is composed out of these 7 things. He also found that 7 organs in the human body, 7 important organs in the human body, etc. Everything is based on 7. Beecher and Stahl proposed that phlogiston was the principle that accounted for combustion, acid property, sharp taste, etc. Springiness in the air, all kinds of things. Okay? And it's been suggested, take a look on Wikipedia, the talk page on phlogiston, that we really shouldn't be talking about negative oxygen as an example. What people were talking about is phlogiston, the modern analog is really material state, gas, solid, liquid, or maybe entropy, or maybe valence electrons in redox, you know, reduction in oxidation equation. It always used to bother me that we could talk about oxidation without any oxygen in chemistry. But all right, a little hangover there from earlier times. Kuhn points out that Kitcher, who wants to translate phlogiston in the old text, has to sometimes use negative oxygen, sometimes hydrogen, sometimes principle of metalness, sometimes principle of springiness, and sometimes nothing fits. And sometimes the statements that are made seem either ridiculous or totally obvious, and you wonder, what in the world would somebody bother to say that? Well, hey, it's a different way of looking at things. So when Priestley would say something like, you know, this is my dephlogisticated air, he meant something different than when Lavoisier says, oh, that's oxygen. Okay? Further, a great many other concepts change their meaning. For example, principle, which is not law. We don't use principles like that at all anymore. Elements, compounds, mixtures, proportionality, heat, fire, air, gas, liquid, solid, matter, substance, transmutation, transubstantiation, and the philosopher's stone.
Now, there are lots of misunderstandings of Kuhn. Kuhn doesn't say paradigms can't be compared, it's just difficult. He does not say that the choice of paradigm is totally irrational. It's rational as well as irrational. And he doesn't see himself as a relativist because he says there is progress. Okay? It's just that we have to wait a little while to find out which of these paradigms is better at solving puzzles. And its improvement is a matter of solving puzzles, not a matter of getting closer to some ontological understanding of what's really out there. Okay? There is a Darwinian evolution of paradigms in which paradigms struggle for and win out over other paradigms. Why is this? The progress is not unidirectional. In some ways, Aristotle and Einstein are closer to each other than either of them is to Newton. For example, in Aristotle and in Einstein, there is an explanation of why gravity occurs. Okay? There's a reason for this. In Newton, it's left as kind of a spooky action at a distance. Okay? But he says there's really no theory independent way to reconstruct phrases like really out there. Because when you start talking that way, you're talking realist, etc., you know. How do you know? How do you get outside the mind? Etc. That kind of talk, by the way, also ignores history. So, how we think? The brain, the mind, is not primarily an engine of rationality. We don't think rationally. We're not like computers. But if we grasp how we do think, we should be able to build better machines and better arguments. Consider modern healthcare debate. And the Republican suggestion that we ought to reframe the public option as the government option. You see, the public is likely to like the idea of a public option. But since we've been telling them all along for so many years, the government can't do anything right. If we call it the government option, then they'll, you know, think it's a bad idea. There is, I think, a movement toward consequentialism, basically. And the increased variation of concepts and stances, and we are aware of this. Okay? So I think we're moving toward this consequentialist stance that I've come up with. And, unfortunately, because of the wide variety of terms that are used, like predictions by Hawkins, paradigm by Kuhn, this is going to obscure this. People won't see this for a while, but I think people will. The sciences, I think, are going to be seen as less mechanistic than they have been in the past. And physics will probably play a smaller role in the public consciousness. Problems with basic terms, there are an awful lot of terms that I think I mentioned several in the introduction. For example, the word knowledge, which we frequently try to define as justified true belief. Instead of one set of problems, I've got three sets of problems. Because all of those are problematic. The demarcation problem. How do you split science from other faiths? So far, all the attempts to demarcate science have failed. I think that there's no effort based on scientific method or rules of thought that can succeed. There really is no scientific method. Feyerabend is right on this when he critiques method, scientific method. There simply isn't a scientific method. And any attempt to come up with a scientific method will be seen as a limitation on the part of some scientist who wants to use some other method. Not even for justification. Okay, not for a discovery, not for justification. We can't do that. What might succeed is some kind of demarcation of communities. Here's a community that means this sort of thing by these words. But I think that would be a bad idea because that will tend to isolate and obscure that particular community. Progress in science is not a matter of finding out what's really out there. It's never been a matter of collecting, you know, one truth here, one truth there, until we come up to the understanding of what's really out there. It has always been an evolution of language, driven by our past and present efforts to communicate and to solve problems. This is occurring not just in science, but in every use of language. Insanities.
it's become obvious that thought is amenable to perversity. If I'm perverse enough, I can argue for all kinds of things. Insane positions cannot, or can be rationally defended. Maybe we can lure them out, maybe we can trick them out, but whether we do or not, eventually these insanities that we say about us will be replaced by other insanities. And with reference to the role of art. Because of the presence of choice and undetermined character of our conclusions, our construments, it's become evident to me that life itself is an art form. We construe our self-concept and the rest of our phenomenal world in an artistic way. And science can be helpful, but it too is an art form. And I'm done. Come up and ask some questions.
Yeah, I was going to say, why don't we actually move the mouse over here?
Sure.
So I think we can even turn it off.
Well, no, we've got time.
Okay, I want to talk about something. So, yes, we'll entertain a few questions. And so if you would keep your, make your question actually a question and not be elaborating on something, we'll take maybe about 10 minutes. Okay, and we have a question here.
Can you give us a one sentence definition of function?
Our instruments of reality are not determined by reason or experience.
Okay.
Right. In one of your slides, when you said that the question is, could the geometry prove this useless question?
Yeah.
And is it useless because it's too simplistic, it's too broad?
No.
In other words, if you would say, is Euclidean geometry helpful in explaining, providing problem solving, developing problem solving skills for eighth graders? Is that a useless question? And I would say that's not a useless question.
Why? And Point Carré says the same thing. It's a question of convenience. It's not true or false. It's convenient or not convenient. Now, it is interesting that Reichenbach, for example, in the Berlin Circle, argued, I have this on a slide, but I skipped over it. It is not, we cannot say that Euclidean geometry is true or false, or non-Euclidean geometry is true or false, but we can say, truly, that some of space is non-Euclidean. Now this is a contortion, okay? It's difficult because he wants to come up with some absolute proof, okay? And from his perspective, Einstein has just proved that space is not Euclidean. Therefore, we can dump Euclid, okay? But what Poincaré and others are saying, no. It's a matter of convention. You choose a convention. You can use polar coordinates if you want. You can use Cartesian coordinates. Sometimes it's easier to use polar than it is to use Cartesian. It depends on the problem.
Okay.
Frank,
sir,
technology might be loosely and generally defined as anything that improves our predictable control of our experiences. Wouldn't it be fair to say that scientific paradigms actually evolve to the degree that they expand technology? That's really the only basis of scientific evolution. For example, if something in mechanics had been the ultimate paradigm, I wouldn't have a cell phone in my hand. Just one mechanics to do that. Therefore, neither theory is ultimate truth. It seems like one mechanics is facilitated for technology, so it could be scientific.
Yeah, in that sense, there is progress, but it is not progress toward ultimate truth, because we will probably continue on this road forever, until we wipe ourselves out.
Okay, there's a couple, okay, here and then here. Go ahead.
I was going to say, can't math be also an art form? If science can be an art form, which is based on math, a lot for the conclusions or quantification of the phenomenon?
There certainly is a lot of art in mathematics, and there's artistic appreciation, aesthetic appreciation of mathematical formula, etc. I don't know if I want to say that mathematics is purely art. I don't think I would go that far.
Metaphor is the universe, perhaps. Metaphor.
Yeah, it certainly is it's a useful method. Yeah, the problem is, you could take a mathematical formalization of Aristotle's concept of forces. He said, if you have a force which is twice as big as another force, which impacts a body, it will move that body twice as far. Now, this is totally non-Newtonian, but you can put this in the form of an equation. F equals K times the mass times the distance. Okay? F equals KD. Well, that's not Newtonian. Okay? For Newton, it's F equals MA. It's a very different equation, but it's also mathematical. And it's, observable. If I, hit a block of wood sitting on the table, and I hit it twice as hard, it would go twice as far on the table, unless it falls off. I mean, so he's right. It's, controllable in that sense. It's mathematical, but neither of them are right.
Craig,
you're talking about science won't come up with an absolute truth. It seems like that the attempt to come up with a unified field theory would be one of the ultimate challenges of that theory. Now, what would be your critique of taking down the unified field theory, saying that it's arbitrary or out of sight?
Unfortunately, it hasn't been achieved. Einstein tried to the end of his life. He was certain that, it was out there. He could do it, perhaps. He never made it. Nowadays, most physicists find that, not to be an interesting question. They want to pursue string theory, something else, M theory. Brain theory, whatever. B-R-A-N-D-R, not B-R-A-I-N. But in any of these attempts, they will not be final. There will always be something more to figure out. A different way of looking at things. As the language changes, the questions will change. And we will be looking for a different type of answer.
All right, let's have one more question. The gentleman right there.
You said that this would go on forever until we blow ourselves up. Do you believe it's inevitable that, we will be unable at some point to hold the line against insanity?
So far we're
backing up.
It's tough. I really don't know the answer to that. I'm uncertain. And I don't mean to say that, I know we're going to blow ourselves up. I don't know that. We might be hit by a passing comet. I don't know what
I'm supposed to